Capital Report is underwritten in part by Hopping Green and Sams, which salutes its client CF Industries for its continuing generous contributions to local communities and charitable organizations in Central Florida each year. I'm Susan Stevens of Hopping Green and Sams Law Firm.
The Able Trust, encouraging businesses to hire someone with a disability. More information about the benefits of hiring people with a wide range of abilities is available on the web at lookatmyability.org. The Able Trust, because people want to work. The Fresh from Florida program, supporting Florida's economy by promoting agricultural products grown right here at home, including a variety of seafood harvested by commercial fishermen along Florida's Gulf Coast, on the web at freshfromflorida.com. And Florida Tax Watch, the Florida Council of 100, the Florida Lottery, and AvMed Health Plan, proud sponsors of the Prudential Davis Productivity Awards program, recognizing and rewarding Florida's innovative state employees for their cost-saving ideas since 1989. WFSU-FM Tallahassee, and other Florida public radio stations. From the state capitol, the Florida Public Radio Network brings you Capitol Report.
Tuition is going up again this year in Florida's public universities, but some students aren't fazed by that.
Florida students are used to paying next to nothing for college compared to what other states pay for. The outrage is understandable, but I think it's a little misplaced.
Faced by an impending budget cut, Florida's courthouses are bracing for a reduction in hours and the services they offer the public.
Typical courthouse activity includes people trying to race here after work, trying to come on payday to get their fines paid. So it's going to be tough.
Multiple lawsuits have been filed in connection with Florida's voter purge, but government officials maintain they're working to ensure the integrity of elections. I'm Tom Flanagan, sitting in for Tramell Gomes, who's on assignment. Welcome to Capitol Report. A months-long debate between Florida Governor Rick Scott and the state's public universities over tuition increases came to a head this week, and the result disappointed both sides. Students will pay more for their classes this year, and as Lynn Hatter reports, negotiations over how much more they will pay reveal divisions in the board that oversees the schools.
Once upon a time, and not too long ago, the Florida Board of Governors, which oversees the state's public universities, simply co-signed on the school's request to raise tuition. The process was simple, smooth, and in past years, done with little debate. But not this time.
I would be more inclined to support 11 instead of our current proposal.
Okay. 12. I'm at 12.
Oh, you're at 12.
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I thought you were 9. Okay,
I'm 12. At 12.
I think Governor Root meant 14.
This year, the board picked apart the school's tuition requests, at times pulling numbers seemingly out of thin air. Board of Governors Chairman Dean Colson found himself acting as an auctioneer as his board haggled over how big a tuition increase each state university should get. The process was long and fraught with tension, leading board member Ava Parker to say,
"And maybe you guys said it was never any method to our madness, but it really seems to really not to be any method to our madness right now."
The process for deciding how much to let schools raise tuition revealed just how divided the board is. Its newest members, those appointed by Governor Rick Scott, largely voted no for any increase at any amount.
Hassaney?
No.
Beard?
Yes.
Carter?
No.
Kuntz?
No.
The governor had addressed the board earlier in the week, saying he wants tuition to remain low. In Scott's words, he wants the state to be number one in affordability.
They've already raised tuition. Our universities, I think, on average, 71% in 4 years. And look at this. You can almost pick up any paper and look at the amount of debt these students have at a time where it's difficult to get a job. So I'll be surprised if there's significant tuition increases.
Scott has said for the past several months that he doesn't support tuition hikes at Florida's public universities. He says the schools should prioritize and cut their budgets. The university system has lost 45% of its state-based funding over the past few years, and tuition hikes make up only about 35 cents for every dollar lost. So the schools have had to cut programs and lay off faculty and staff. And at a cost of about $5,500 per year, the state also has the 45th lowest tuition rate in the nation.
Florida students are used to paying next to nothing for college compared to what other states pay for. The outrage is understandable, but I think it's a little misplaced.
Harris Neeland is in his last semester at Florida State University. His tuition has been paid for through a prepaid plan his parents set up for him as a child. He plans to go on to a graduate program where a partial scholarship will still leave him with about $50,000 in student loans that he estimates he'll have to take out. But Jana Beasley, who plans to transfer to FSU in the fall from Tallahassee Community College, doesn't have a prepaid plan. She doesn't have one of the state's Bright Futures scholarships either. Her tuition is paid through financial aid, mainly a Pell Grant, which goes pretty far. But she worries the grant won't be enough once she enters Florida State.
My greatest concern is just having to be held back due to not having enough finances or something like that from not getting Bright Futures or having Florida prepaid.
At Thursday's Board of Governors meeting, the debate over tuition raged on, with universities like FSU seeing their requested tuition increases cut down. FSU had wanted to raise rates by 15%.
Kuntz?
No.
Parker?
No.
Perez?
Yes.
Robinson?
No.
After two rounds of no votes on a 15% increase and then a 14% increase, FSU President Eric Barron had finally heard enough.
That's an amazing message that the ranked universities in this state and the research universities in this state will get the least resources to advance students.
I would hope that we have a minute of silence.
Mr. Chairman, I changed my vote.
Great.
A single switched vote got FSU to a 13% tuition increase. In the end, all schools that requested a price hike got it, but for some, whose balance sheets have fallen below the state-mandated levels due to budget cuts, it wasn't what they needed. After the votes, Governor Scott weighed in again, saying he was disappointed by the board's decisions. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
For Florida residents making payments or filing papers at the courthouse, things are about to get tougher. As Jessica Palumbo reports, that's because clerks of court are facing a budget shortfall that's forcing them to cut back hours and full-time staffers.
Starting July 1st, the state's court clerks are facing a 7% budget cut. So about half of the state's clerks are cutting back the hours they're open to the public. In most cases, that means opening an hour later and closing an hour earlier. Sarasota court clerk Karen Rushing anticipates the reduced hours will make it harder for people to pay fines and file papers.
Well, you know, typical courthouse activity includes people trying to race here after work, trying to come on payday to get their fines paid, to try to maybe come before work so that they don't lose their, money at their jobs, to try to take care of the obligations they have here. So it's going to be tough.
And she says it will slow down the mechanics of the civil court system.
And it's going to be disruptive to the legal community, who uses the afternoon primarily for filing documents.
Not only that, but clerks say the statewide budget reduction of about $30 million will cause longer turnaround times for document processing, especially with the recent increase in civil caseload in many parts of the state. And even without the budget cut, court clerks already have trouble meeting performance standards for timely collection and processing. Last year, only 5 of Florida's 67 counties met 100% of their performance objectives. But rather than hiring full-time staff to pick up the slack, many counties have hired part-time employees who don't receive benefits and don't cost as much. Leon County Courts Director Gypsy Bailey says none of her employees have received raises in the past 5 years. She says as a manager, it's frustrating to watch them give more and more and get no greater rewards in return.
You're working and you're working hard, but you're still struggling at home to pay your bills and your student loans and take care of your children. And you know you do good work and you're appreciated here at work, and yet you have nothing in your checking account or your wallet to prove that.
Other county clerks have been even worse off, closing branch offices and laying off staff. And this was all before this year's budget cut, which will soon force even more belt tightening. But clerks still have one last hope for the money to be restored. Leon County Clerk Bob Inzer says all eyes will be on a legislative budget panel that's meeting next month.
There's an opportunity for them to make adjustments to our budget during that time frame. The governor has come out, made comments supportive of making those changes. We know that other legislators have as well, and we're hopeful that that will be on the agenda. Clearly, if the legislature does come back and fully fund our budgets, we would be restoring those hours and going back to our normal schedule.
If funding is restored, the money would not come from Florida's general budget, but rather from a trust fund composed of fines the court system collects. Last year, the courts collected more than $1 billion, but the legislature reduced the percentage clerks were authorized to spend on their day-to-day operations. The legislative budget panel, that could increase that spending power once again, meets on July 12th. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jessica Palumbo.
Still to come on Capitol Report, the Florida Department of Law Enforcement is clearing Governor Scott of any criminal wrongdoing related to the loss of his transitional emails after what's being called a very extensive investigation.
A lot of these are pages and pages. I mean, I think there would literally be boxes and boxes and boxes of documents.
Florida's drought continues, with the north central part of the state especially hard hit.
Well, I've seen the lake full, and it looks like I'm going to live long enough to see it dry. And it's not going to take much longer for it to be dry.
And despite near-record drought in the state, Florida's many mosquitoes continue to bug us.
They are preventing disease transmission, and they are protecting our quality of life.
The Florida Department of Law Enforcement has cleared Governor Rick Scott of any wrongdoing associated with the loss of governor's transition emails. Regan McCarthy reports the investigation led to the recovery of more than 30,000 pages of documents that are now available to the public online.
Governor Rick Scott used email relatively frequently during the time period between his election and the day he officially took office. Generally, the emails an elected official sends and receives during that transition period are counted as part of the public record. But most of the Scott emails were lost when his transition team closed the email accounts. The Florida Department of Law Enforcement, which Scott asked to investigate the matter, ruled the move was unintentional and not done maliciously. FDLE spokesman Keith Kamig says the investigation lasted 10 months.
It resulted in us reviewing thousands of pages of documents, and the governor's office has been very helpful to FDLE, providing us everything we asked for.
And the governor's spokesman, Lane Wright, says recovering the documents took some pretty tedious efforts.
A lot of these are pages and pages. I mean, I think there would literally be boxes and boxes and boxes of documents.
Wright says the governor's transition team tracked down documents in any way they could, looking for printed versions, checking with other people they might have forwarded the emails to, and working with the Florida Department of Law Enforcement to conduct an electronic forensic search. The FDLE got involved in the investigation when Scott asked the group to look into the matter after members of the media and the First Amendment Foundation made public records requests for a number of the governor's transition documents. Barbara Peterson is the president of the First Amendment Foundation in Florida. She says the FDLE's finding doesn't change the fact that Scott's emails never should have been missing.
You know, FDLE has found there was no intent to violate the law. And that's, I would say, you know, but the fact is that we still have a retention requirement.
At the time the Scott emails went missing, it was common practice that transition emails should be kept for the public record. Since then, legislators have passed a measure specifying that the governor-elect, as well as the lieutenant governor and members of the cabinet's transition emails, fall under the state's public records laws. And Peterson points out it's a measure the governor supported. But Peterson says really she's just happy the investigation is over and that the materials are going to be up online.
It's taken a long time, and I'm glad that we're finally getting at least most of the transition team records. I mean, we've been trying to get access to these records for over a year now. So I am glad it's over, and I'm glad that the governor is putting those emails online.
And Wright, Scott's spokesman, says any member of the public can access the documents on the state's website, Project Sunburst.
So I'm going to flgov.com/sunburst. And then right here on the page, there's only a couple links here, but if you scroll down towards the bottom of the page, there's something that says transition documents. And you can see the FDLE report. The full report is posted in a link here. I'm not going to go to that right now. And then you can also see where it says click here to access transition documents. So clicking there.
Once the site comes up, it's an organized list of PDF files, which are mostly scanned documents and emails from people like Susie Wiles, then Scott's campaign manager, and his communications director, Brian Burgess. And Wright says the cool thing is the documents themselves are searchable, like this one he opened from the Department of Corrections.
So let's say I'm looking for something with the Department of Corrections. I don't know. I'm just going to type in Control F on my browser to do a search with Find. And I'm going to type in, let's type in prison. Holy cow. So there are 674 references to prison or prisons in this document. And if you look at it, you can see, like, on this browser anyway, it kind of shows you with a highlighted where they are.
Wright says he thinks the governor's willingness to post these documents online highlights his commitment to transparency. The First Amendment Foundation says it also plans to post copies of the documents on its site as well. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Florida is now facing a third lawsuit challenging the Department of State's efforts to purge ineligible voters from the rolls. Ronald J. Ebbin reports a group of voter and civil rights organizations are filing a lawsuit alleging the purge is discriminatory.
Kathy Culverton Gonzalez is with a group called Advancement Project. She says the organizations are the first to sue under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. It's a move, she says, that will give the suit staying power.
It's not going to only be a ban on the purges in the 90 days before any federal election, but it's going to be permanent and year-round.
Culleton Gonzalez says that's what sets her group's lawsuit apart from the others that have been filed so far. She says Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act specifically prohibits discrimination of voters of color. And she says that's clearly what Florida's purge does, pointing out that 87% of the people on the purge list are people of color. And that's the reason the group takes issue with Governor Scott's argument that anyone inappropriately removed from the rolls can cast a provisional ballot. Culleton Gonzalez says many minority voters might not understand their options and could be intimidated by the government's efforts. And Ben Hovland with the Fair Elections Legal Network says removing voters from the rolls might keep those voters from getting important information.
Florida statutes require you to cast a provisional ballot within the correct precinct. And so if someone were to show up on election day, well, one, if they are removed from the list, they're not going to get the information they need about their correct precinct. And then if they show up at a polling location they see and no one is able to verify that they're in the correct precinct, the provisional ballot that they end up casting very well may not be counted.
But Florida Secretary of State Ken Detzner maintains his office is working to ensure the integrity of Florida's elections.
The credibility of the very election process that we've been talking about relies on good voter rolls, clean voter rolls of eligible voters.
Department of State officials contend the purge is not discriminatory, saying the only criteria they're looking for is whether someone is eligible to cast a vote. Meanwhile, a Quinnipiac University poll released earlier this week shows the majority of Floridians support the voter purge. Scott says that's a number he's not surprised to hear.
I've not met one person in the state that thinks that non-U.S. citizens should be voting in our elections. Nobody does. And it's my job to make sure that I do everything I can to make sure that only U.S. citizens vote in our races.
The same poll shows Scott's overall approval rating is down, with 49% of voters disapproving of the way Scott is doing his job, 39% showing approval. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ronald J. Ebbin.
You're listening to Capitol Report on the Florida Public Radio Network. I'm Tom Flanagan in for Tramell Gomes, who's on assignment. Area lakes in north central Florida are at record lows as dry conditions continue in the area and statewide. Florida Public Radio's Kelsey Peck reports on how the low water levels in the Keystone Heights region just northeast of Gainesville have business owners and residents hoping for rainfall for more reasons than one.
Virgil Allison lives with his significant other Shirley off of Lake Geneva in Keystone Heights.
But you see how it's all dry down there? And you see how the lake is in little puddles, a puddle here, a puddle there, so forth. You can't run a boat in there.
Or what's left of it.
They drive down the lake.
Yeah, yeah. They can drive all the way across there to that other side.
He used to fish in his boat on Lake Geneva along with other lake residents, but like a truck, a boat doesn't have four-wheel drive. However, people are still making use of what has become of the waterway in their backyard.
I see them on the lake out there with those metal detectors looking for things, walking around. That's what you see out there most of the time now. I haven't seen a boat out there in a long time. I don't remember seeing a boat out there in a year.
And if people can't use their boats, they may question owning one. Down the road from Keystone is Melrose, where Chad Hovsepian owns and operates the Lake Area Water Sports, which sells boats, wakeboards, and water gear. But lately, Hovsepian's customers aren't coming in to buy boats, but rather to sell them.
I'm flooded with consignment sales now. Customers called me up, Chad, I need to sell my boat.
In the last 4 months, Little Swan Lake in Melrose has separated into two bodies of water, with a football size of its sandy lake bottom between the two. In Keystone, extremely low water levels in Lake Johnson prevent campers at Goldhead State Park from using the lake. And Lake Geneva, which is home to Keystone Beach, and Lake Brooklyn have set new record lows this year. St. John's River Water Management District spokeswoman Teresa Munson says the area's geology combined with extreme drought and regional groundwater pumping affects the water levels.
The numerous lakes that are in that area have sandy bottoms and that sort of those sandy permeable soils allow significant downward leakage of water.
Despite the extremely low lake levels, Hovsepian does want to remind avid boaters like himself that boating has not become a pastime in Melrose, the city of beautiful lakes. That's what the sign reads as you cross over into town.
You know, there are places to boat still. There, you know, Lake Santa Fe still has a boat ramp that's open on 21B. People are traveling to it. You know, there's a Black Creek. You can go to Black Creek. There, you can go to Palatka. So there are still places to boat. And people that really enjoy boating and know what it does to their family life, nothing's going to stop them from getting out in their boat.
Residents can only hope this year's storm season will bring relief to the area. But for Virgil Allison, he doesn't sound so sure.
So I've seen the lake full, and it looks like I'm going to live long enough to see it dry. And it's not going to take much longer for it to be dry.
Only time will tell to see if Mother Nature can prove him wrong. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kelsey Peck.
As dry as things have been in Florida, the state's still plagued by mosquitoes. But as bad as the bugs may seem, Florida Public Radio's Jill Robertson for Pierce reports things could be a lot worse.
A million of something can be hard to contemplate. But when you do think of things in that number, it's nice to picture something pleasant, like dollars. But dollars are not what they were counting in St. Lucie County this winter.
We were collecting between a half a million and a million mosquitoes a week.
Jim David is head of St. Lucie County Mosquito Control. The warm winter has made for good mosquito breeding, as those who live in coastal areas can attest.
Even though we were early larvaciding, ground adulticiding, and hand treating almost every single day.
David tells us we most likely are not aware of the extent to which mosquito control efforts make our area more livable. An excerpt from Patrick Smith's classic Florida novel, A Land Remembered, reads like this. Cows were bucking, kicking, and falling around him as Zek raced across the marsh. As soon as a cow hit the ground, mosquitoes swarmed over it and formed a solid mass in its mouth and nose, blocking air from its lungs and causing the cow's eyes to pop out as it tried to bellow but could not do so. The shipwrecked Jonathan Dickinson told of burying himself in the sand to avoid being bitten as he tried to sleep. And Jim David says the area was once known as Mosquito County.
If the impoundment was not here, there would be no nighttime activity in Fort Pierce. There would be no nighttime activity on the drive. No matter how many times we'd fly airplanes at killing adult mosquitoes and treating and retreating the marshes, it would be a losing equation.
But mosquitoes are kept at bay, in part by the Bear Point Mosquito Impoundment, located south of the Fort Pierce Inlet. From May through September, the county's website says 49,000 gallons of water per minute are continuously pumped into the impoundment's culverts. Bear Point is the very first such impoundment established in the state in 1935, and the concept is simple.
By having the water on the marsh surface, the adult females cannot lay their eggs anywhere. So we're basically preventing them from increasing their populations because they have no place to develop large populations.
Bear Point is also a popular place for fishermen with several fishing piers which stretch into the Indian River Lagoon. And mangroves are just about all you see growing, no room for invasive plants. In all, the county has 22 managed impounds and others which are smaller than Bear Point's 12 acres and largely unmanaged.
They are preventing disease transmission, they are protecting our quality of life to the point where most people have no inkling as to the fact that they are still in what could be considered Mosquito County if we were not... Yes, it could still be Mosquito County if we were not managing. If for some reason we ceased to manage the coastal wetlands, St. Lucie County would revert to Mosquito County within a year.
But there are no plans for that to happen. So while it does seem often that there are way more mosquitoes than we would like, without control efforts, we would at times find the area unlivable. For Florida Public Radio, this is Jill Roberts.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Jessica Palumbo. Thanks also to the contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report provided by Taylor Cox. And I'm Tom Flanagan in for Tramell Gomes. Join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at fprn.org.
Capitol Report is underwritten in part by Hopping Green and Sams, which salutes its client CF Industries for its continuing generous contributions to local communities and charitable organizations in Central Florida each year. I'm Susan Stevens of Hopping Green and Sams Law Firm.
The Able Trust, helping donors make a difference through planned giving, putting donations to work so people with disabilities can too. On the web at abletrust.org. The Able Trust, because people want to work. The Fresh from Florida program, supporting Florida's economy by promoting agricultural products grown right here at home, including a variety of seafood harvested by commercial fishermen along Florida's Gulf Coast, on the web at freshfromflorida.com. And Florida Tax Watch, the Florida Council of 100, the Florida Lottery, and AvMed Health Plan, proud sponsors of the Prudential Davis Productivity Awards program, recognizing and rewarding Florida's innovative state employees for their cost-saving ideas since 1989. WFSU-FM Tallahassee, and other Florida public radio stations. This is the Florida Public Radio Network.